Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. In scientific circles, there's an increasing awareness that research data and findings should be more accessible to the general public. Often, visual aids such as graphs, tables, and images are used to help explain concepts or impart information. While these approaches work for those in the sighted community, they're not so helpful for those with visual impairments. Today, we discuss Accessible Oceans, a project turning ocean science data into auditory displays. It's a joint project with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, University of Oregon, and Georgia Tech, with funding from the National Science Foundation. Joining us in studio is Amy Bauer, physical oceanographer and senior scientist at HUWI. Welcome back. It's been a while. Good to see you.
Yes, it has. Good to be with you.
Also joining us is John Bologna. He's a sound artist with Harmonic Laboratory and senior instructor of audio production at the University of Oregon. Amy, you've been thinking about the sonification of ocean science data for a long time because you are visually impaired. At what age did your visual impairment begin?
It started when I was in graduate school. Until then, I was normally sighted, and I was so excited to be an oceanographer or to study one. I was super excited. But when I was a couple years into my PhD program, I was diagnosed with a degenerative retinal disease that was going to slowly decrease my vision over years. It wasn't a catastrophic fall, but and I was pretty devastated at the time because I didn't know a single blind person at all, much less a blind scientist. So I wasn't sure it could be done. So I guess, you know, I just took a kind of one day at a time attitude. I had some great supports from some low vision specialists, and they had great ideas. And I kind of kept it going one day at a time as the vision declined. But at all that time, I've been looking for accessibility tools like data sonification.
Yeah. So you set down this path of becoming an oceanographer. So what's your research focus?
I study deep ocean circulation, primarily in the North Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. I look at, try to understand where these currents are going and if they're changing under global warming scenarios.
Mm-hmm. So as your vision became progressively worse, what were some of those adaptive strategies you used to continue on with your research and your work?
Initially, I could use magnification. So I could magnify the text and graphics on my computer screen. That was relatively straightforward. There's also a device called a video magnifier where you can put printed material under a camera and it displays on the screen in a magnified and a high contrast way. That was a staple for many years. That worked. But as my vision got worse, magnification wasn't helping anymore. And then I turned to screen readers, which are software packages that allow all the computer content to be spoken out loud. Plus, everything I type is spoken out loud. So that works great for text, but not for data and graphics.
Yeah. We should mention that your research doesn't keep you in a lab or an office. You've gone on numerous oceanographic research cruises for weeks and months at a time. Tell us a little more about the challenges and the joys of being at sea.
Oh, it has been the favorite part of the career, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, challenges just getting around the ship safely. In home life, land life, I use a guide dog. But at sea, I don't take the dog. I think it would be very uncomfortable for them. So I use a white mobility cane when I'm at sea just to make get around. But in fact, it's not as dangerous as you might imagine because safety is the primary focus on any vessel, and especially an academic research vessel. So everything's tied down. Corridors are all wide open. You know, it's very regular. I know what to expect everywhere I'm walking. So it's not as bad as it might seem. But I love the travel aspect, too, going to other countries.
Do you remember when and why you first started thinking about sonifying ocean research data?
I had started to hear about it in the media, basically, a little bit. But then, in fact, on this very program, The Point, I heard you interview a professor, I think he was from University of Pennsylvania, who was doing data sonification. He was not visually impaired. He was sighted, but he was this was his specialty. And I learned there was such a specialty from your program. And so after he was interviewed, I made a cold call to him, and I said, I'm very interested in what you're doing. I'm visually impaired. I'm a scientist, and I want to get into data sonification. So we went from there.
Yeah. Yeah. So before Accessible Oceans, you wrote a grant to develop an accessible museum exhibit featuring data sonification of Ocean Observatory's initiative data. So what happened with that proposal, and how did you ultimately make the connection with John?
That proposal, Mark, who was the person you interviewed, and I bit off almost more than we could chew. We were not experts in the program we applied to at NSF. It's called Advancing Informal STEM Learning. It was our first time applying for funding in that arena. And the proposal was declined. It was a very ambitious project, too. We were a little out of our depth, I think. And so we were declined funding at that time. Sadly, right around that same time, Mark passed away. And that was really a shock. It was very unexpected. And it took me about a year or so to recover. And then I reached out to Mark's mentor, who I'd met, and asked her, is there someone else out in your community of data sonification who I might connect with? And she recommended John.
All right.
Yeah.
John, tell us more about the craft of sound artistry and your work with Harmonic Laboratory.
Okay. So it was really awesome to first just get a call, just a cold call from Amy, and to be asked to do sonifications. It was kind of my first time to be asked specifically to collaborate on a project for data sonification. Usually for sonification, I'm working on my own. I'm doing sound design. I'm an audio instructor at the University of Oregon. I teach a course in data sonification. So it was really, really cool just to be involved and be asked to in this project. The work that I do is quite varied. So I'm a co-director of Harmonic Laboratory. We're an arts organization here in Eugene, Oregon. We do media arts, combining different disciplines, interdisciplinary art practice that often involves art and science. We did a whole kind of two-hour theater production on Nikola Tesla as part of an OCF Oregon Creative Heights Creative Heights grant back in 2018. We do large video wall displays. We do sound art. The research that I do here at the university also involves data sonification. Mm.
So what was your reaction then when Amy reached out to you? You said, you were glad to hear, but did you go, wow, this sounds really cool? I mean, what were you thinking when she said, hey, I got this idea?
I just love new projects. I love being able to learn about what someone's expertise is in and get to share kind of my knowledge and have that kind of add to a project. And so I really was just excited about doing it. I mean, one of the first data sonifications that I made for Amy, even before the grant, involved carbon net flux between the ocean and the atmosphere. And in just kind of doing that, is just kind of almost like a one-off and seeing like, okay, let's see what sticks or try this out. I was just pleasantly surprised the work kind of resonated with Amy and, kind of almost like without even knowing concept that the ocean breathes. I didn't really know the science behind what I was kind of sonifying, but some of the choices in the sound design and the mapping related to breathing. I used values in there to indicate the release of carbon into the atmosphere, which kind of in that mapping ended up sounding like exhaling, like
yeah. And we're gonna, and a little bit later in the show, we're gonna hear some of that. But Amy, what did you learn from that first failed proposal for data sonification, and how did that help shape the Accessible Oceans project?
I learned what I didn't know for sure, that this was a much bigger field of research than I had realized. So with the new team, John and I eventually invited a professor of learning sciences from and human-computer interaction from Georgia Tech, and also named Jessica Roberts, and then Leslie Smith, Your Ocean Consulting, who's a ocean science educator and communicator, joined us. And I started to learn, wow, this is a big field. If we're going to be competitive, we need all this expertise together. And it was very exciting to have such an interdisciplinary team working on this together And so we bit off something much smaller in our next project or proposal. And that's what Accessible Oceans is. We designed a pilot study, something much more reasonable, in preparation for an eventual museum exhibit, we hope, based on ocean data and sonification.
There are vast quantities of ocean science data. So, I mean, tell us more about the data sets you used for this project.
Yes. Okay. I also want to take just a minute to make sure everyone understands what data sonification is exactly.
Yeah.
Data sonification is basically a mapping of numbers into sounds. So we take data sets, data streams of numbers, and convert them to sound. And there's some very simple mappings that can be done just to, John calls it my data karaoke, where you just take some numbers. High numbers means high frequency. Mm-hmm. So low numbers, low frequency. So you end up with something, to represent up and down numbers, higher and lower numbers. But we try to be much more sophisticated than that and more thoughtful about the sounds that we choose. So, in this new study, we've been much more, we decided to focus on Ocean Observatory's initiative data. This is a huge program of to make a time series of ocean observations at a number of sites around the globe for 35 years, so we can really start to look at trends in ocean properties. Mm-hmm. And then we decided to use what we're called, data nuggets, and our colleague Leslie Smith had already developed some educational modules based on this OOI, or Ocean Observatories Initiative, data. And so we said, okay, great, we've got some mini data sets already selected for their educational value. So let's just start with those.
Mm. I imagine your audience also helped inform what data sets would be more appropriate for sonification, right? So who is the target audience for this project?
Yeah, do you want to answer that, John?
Sure. So the audience that we're really thinking about, since this pilot is inclusive design, we're thinking about specifically blind and low vision BLV learners. Because we're really striving to inclusively design auditory displays, particularly these sonifications, that we really want to convey meaningful aspects of this ocean science data that we have. Mm. So we're kind of striving to also evaluate and kind of validate kind of the feasibility of these displays to kind of promote data literacy in informal learning environments. So an informal learning environment would be like a museum or discovery center. And that's kind of really starting with focusing on blind and low vision learners. We interviewed teachers in blind and low vision schools like Perkins School for the Blind. We interviewed BLV graduate students, and have taken kind of these auditory displays and sonifications in middle and high schools, BLV middle and high schools in Texas, Washington, and Massachusetts.
Wow. So just as a scientist, Amy, I'm just wondering what kinds of data and information stood out to you as you looked through the options of data to mm-hmm. use. Something, mm-hmm. you could consider pressing issues like climate change and mm-hmm. look for data that's related. So
I was looking for that kind of data set with the team when we were selecting which ones to focus on. We ended up picking, I think, about five data sets. And we chose them for their relevance to human experience. Climate was certainly a factor. We also chose them for variety of ocean science disciplines. Mm-hmm. So we have like the carbon dioxide exchange, sort of gas exchange, climate. We have a couple on underwater volcanoes.
Oh,
so that's
wow.
geology. We have one on storms at sea, wind, rain, and the effect on ocean temperature. So we chose, because since our audience was museum audiences and the public, they might have a variety of interests,
right.
And not just a single discipline of ocean science.
Yeah, very exciting. We're talking about Accessible Oceans, a project turning ocean science data into auditory displays. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about Accessible Oceans, a project turning ocean science data into auditory displays. With us in studio is Amy Bauer, physical oceanographer and senior scientist at HUI. On the phone, John Bologna, sound artist with Harmonic Laboratory and senior instructor of audio production at the University of Oregon. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We got an email from Ken who says, presumably the brain processes oral information differently from visual information. Are there things a sighted scientist can learn from sonifying data that they might not see?
Yeah, I'm so glad that question came in. During the break, I was actually thinking of bringing that up. Definitely, even though maybe this project was inspired by a need for accessibility by blind and low vision public and scientists, it's true that that type of display actually benefits everyone, even those who are fully sighted. It's understanding, as the emailer says, the brain does process information a little bit differently, and sometimes the ears hear something the eyes cannot see. Mm-hmm. And there are scientists, blind and fully sighted scientists, who use data sonification to explore their data sets, especially prevalent in astronomy, which has reams and reams and reams of data, as ocean scientists are starting to have, and trying to look for patterns. And the ears can pick up patterns sometimes the eyes can't see.
So
yeah. I think one of the earliest sonific, sorry for jumping in, but I think one of the earliest successful sonifications that we find applicable in the world is the Geiger counter. We're transforming and ionizing radiation into sound in real time, and that clicking sound that you hear is kind of this warning as you get closer to source of radiation, that click, 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 click. And so I think there's some value in exploring both modalities.
John, what was the original form of the data? I'm trying to imagine getting these data sets as sets of numbers or in graphs or research papers.
These come from HUI, actually manages the OOI data. We're really thankful to Dr. Leslie Smith in creating these data nuggets, kind of curating data sets. And they're coming into just like a data file, like a CSV data file. And so it's like you would open up on an Excel spreadsheet. And so you have the different columns with different streams of values. And in these different data sets, there's also kind of varying types of data. It's another thing that we're interested in picking. Some of them have a single time series, so just happening over time, just one data set, layered time series, so multiple data sets happening over, across time, even multi-dimensional kind of profiles in the water column. And so it's choosing those to convey different processes and to try to develop different techniques or sonifying these sets to see what will work.
So, John, as a sound artist, what are you thinking about as you looked at the data sets? Did you see challenges, opportunities? Walk us through your creative thought process.
Yes, love to. I mean, a lot of times it's trying to look at what is important. What's the kind of core concept or lesson? And Amy and Leslie and Jessica, you know, went through and kind of created core lessons based upon some expert interviews with scientists in the field, or just even with Amy and Leslie coming up with these core lessons. And so one of them might be for carbon dioxide, the ocean breathes. And so it's important for me to understand, okay, how do I convey that not only with this quantitative information that I have, that someone can kind of have that potential lesson takeaway while they're interacting with this sonification. And so some of the things that I'm using in this, a lot of psychoacoustic work, which is the study of sound perception, how we hear sound. So for example, the range of human frequencies that we can hear from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. But often as we age, we're going to lose the top end of our hearing, or even across the audible spectrum, we're going to perceive frequencies differently. So some of the choices I might have will be, what are the range of frequencies? If I'm using frequency as a mapping, I may not choose the really low end of the spectrum because it has to be significantly louder in order to be perceived as the same as, say, the middle range of frequencies. You know, kind of a question being like, what's louder, a timpani or a piccolo? And the answer is actually a piccolo. So you know, kind of where you want to convey information that you want to have the most users be able to hear it.
Yeah. So as part of the sound design, you incorporated a tone or a beep. Explain the use of that tone.
So we actually added in a tone at the beginning and the end of each sonification, kind of almost indicating the start and the end of the sonification. And this actually came about from interviews with teachers at Perkins. And it was really great to understand how do teachers use sound in a classroom. And it kind of, there's a device that they use that when you turn it on, it actually beeps when you turn this device on. And when you turn the device off, it beeps again. That tells you the device is off. Mm-hmm. And it was also in that interview. So that was like an aha moment one. And then two, in the interview, saying that oftentimes when they had sonifications brought in or they're playing sound at the very end, there's a long gap in silence. Because no one knows if it's over. How do we know it's done? Yeah. And
or not just zero values, yeah, which have no sound association.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that was important to just design something that would be indicate, okay, you're going to listen to a song. You're about ready to listen. Okay, the listening's done. And I think that's totally true. Even when I teach sonification and I'm in the classroom at Oregon, those students, sometimes when I play sonification, there's pauses at the end. And I kind of didn't really, it wasn't until this interview that I was had the connecting those dots. Mm. And so that's important. We got to include that.
Yeah. So let's listen to some of the sonification. First round, we're going to hear it's title data. Amy, we should point out that these data sets are not from your research, right? But do you know the geographic location of
this?
Yeah, you do.
Yes. This particular data is collected with a bottom pressure sensor in the Northeast Pacific Ocean off the coast of the Northwest U.S. And it's basically measuring the height of the water above the seafloor.
And the first clip is a sonification of daily tide data. And to be clear, John, this is not a recording of the movement of the water in the tidal cycle. It's sound that you created. Anything in particular we should be listening for in this first sonification?
So in this one, these values I'm mapping onto a cutoff frequency of a filter of white noise. So you're going to kind of hear whooshing sounds that are happening. I can probably get more into it after we listen to it and describe it.
This is the data of the daily tidal cycle. Sounds a little bit like wind, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, John, go ahead.
So on this, some of the key things in that, it's just kind of like you're hearing this whoosh going up and then down, and you hear that kind of that whooshing sound. There's two whooshes in that in one day. And so that kind of really can tell us, communicate, well, there's two high tides in one day. And the values that we're, they're coming from these, the water pressure and the water height that we have is controlling that filter. So it's rather than a human's controlling this knob, we're automating that with data.
And the next sonification we have is of a week's worth of tidal data. Anything you want to say that we should be listening for?
Just listen to the whoosh up and down and kind of see if you can see some period. Listen for repetition or some looping that feels like looping a repetition. And that's where I'm going to say right there.
Okay.
That's like your daily marker.
All right, let's take a listen. So we kind of hear a variation in lows and highs there, right, John?
That's correct. And you're hearing kind of this repetition is just kind of like, oh, there's a day. There's another day of tidal cycle. There's another day of tidal cycle. So then that repetition, our ears are really good about hearing patterns. And that's one that I think just works well with this type of mapping and the sonification.
All right, this next clip, you'll hear the tidal cycle again, but keep your ears tuned for an event. Let's give a listen.
In the last sonification, we heard both the tidal cycle and an underwater volcanic eruption event as measured by a bottom pressure sensor. The seafloor dropped about 2 meters or 6 feet over the course of a few hours in that eruption. Let's listen again to that eruption. This time, we have added a marker to indicate when the eruption occurs. The underwater volcanic eruption event will sound like this. Next is a data sonification of the 2015 axial seamount eruption using 2 weeks of bottom pressure data.
All right, Amy, what do you find compelling or interesting about that sonification?
Yeah, it's very interesting, the audience might benefit from a little bit more explanation. So this sensor is sitting on the seafloor, and it's measuring pressure, so the weight of the water above it. So as the tides goes from high tide to low tide, that the height of that column of water increases and decreases. So the pressure increases and decreases. So that happens every day. Then what happened is this sensor was very close to an underwater volcano. And what happens at this volcano is over many years, a magma chamber under the seafloor fills and then explosively empties during the eruption. When it empties, the seafloor drops, actually, physically drops by about 2 meters or about 6 feet in this case. And now the column of water above the sensor is higher again because the seafloor dropped.
Yeah.
And so that drop in frequency you hear is right when the eruption occurred and the seafloor dropped, right where the sensor was located.
That's fascinating. What has been the response of those who've interacted with the data sonification?
Generally, people really enjoy it. The blind and low vision students that we've tested with like it a lot and are also just happy that someone is addressing their needs and helping to make science more accessible for them. But I've been most surprised by fully sighted people who will sit down for a test and say, I'm no good at science. I'm no good at math. I was terrible in school at math. And then they listen to this sonification and they love it. They love the story, the narration up front that explains it, then the data sonification. Some of these people, I think, are suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome from elementary school and not understanding or being well taught graphics, you know, graph of data and how data is displayed, or just didn't work right with their brain for whatever reason.
We learn differently.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's just been so gratifying to see these fully sighted people get so much out of it.
Yeah. The next sonification we'll hear involves zooplankton. And Amy, you're a physical oceanographer, not a biologist.
Yes.
But would you explain what zooplankton are and their role in the ocean ecosystem?
Yeah. Zooplankton are small, usually pretty microscopic. I think they could be best explained as tiny shrimp, very tiny. Some of them are a little bit visible. Most of them are not. And they live in the upper ocean. They're animals. They're not plants. But they feed on the phytoplankton, which are miniature plants. And then the zooplankton are eaten by bigger fish who are eaten by bigger fish and so on down the line. So zooplankton are a critical link in, as they are the plant eaters, the plant eaters. But they are also food for predators. So they have evolved to avoid predators, but get the food they need. And the best way to do that is to go up. The food is near the surface. So they go up to the surface at night when it's dark and their predators can't see them. And then they go back down during the daytime into the dark ocean where the predators can not see them.
And then, and how do scientists either track this migration?
So they, good question. They have put in the water column what an echo sounder, which is a lot like a fish finder that many people have on fishing boats. It just sends sound into the ocean and it echoes off whatever targets are in the water column, whether it's fish or in this case zooplankton. And it can therefore track how far away the zooplankton are from the sensor. So just like the fish finder can tell you how deep are the fish. So it's exactly the same concept, and we can use these echo sounders to measure the where in the water column the zooplankton are. So we can see them migrate up and down every day.
All right. Let's give a listen to this sonification. It's going to start with John narrating.
Much like a bat uses sound to find insects to eat, scientists use echo sounders to observe the changing depth of zooplankton, tiny shrimp-like animals that live in the upper ocean. Let's listen to some data from an echo sounder on the same buoy in the North Pacific Ocean and see if we can hear the daily movement of zooplankton. In our data sonification, this is what zooplankton swimming upward sounds like. This is what zooplankton swimming downwards sounds like. Now let's listen to data collected by the echo sounder that demonstrates a day in the life of zooplankton as they move up and down in the ocean. Did you hear the zooplankton swim up to the surface, stay near the surface for a while to feed, then move back down to deeper water?
Sure did. All right, John, talk about your choice of sounds for upward and downward migration.
So on this one, I first want to highlight that in this, the data that I have is actually, echo sounder is an image. And so we had to kind of translate this image of the echo sounder into a stream of values that we can then use as our data stream. So that was kind of one of the first processes that we had to do. So on this, you can probably hear kind of like density, like kind of a pulse oscillation that gets more rapid, that's clicking with shorter duration as the zooplankton come up to the surface. And so that's one kind of choice is using that in our sonification. The other actually came as a response to Amy is really wanting to be able to hear the increase and decrease. So in there, we also, I added a tone underneath to kind of also highlight the movement up as the frequency kind of goes up towards the closer to the surface. And then the frequency decreases or gets lower as the zooplankton swim down.
Amy, the data set of zooplankton migration was collected in a period when that region of the ocean experienced a solar eclipse. Did the eclipse impact their migration?
Yes, it definitely did, because they only perceive light and dark. They don't have an eclipse calendar in their brains. So as the solar eclipse occurred, it was like at 10 o'clock in the morning. Normally, they would be down deep because it's daylight. They don't want to be seen by predators. But as the sun started to be covered by the moon, it looked pretty dark to them. So they started to swim up as if it were nighttime. But then the moon passed all off the sun and it got bright again. They go, oh no, whoops.
Let's get out of here.
Let's get out of here. And they quickly swam back down.
Mm. We're talking about Accessible Oceans, a project turning ocean science data into auditory displays. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about Accessible Oceans, a project turning ocean science data into auditory displays. With us is Amy Bauer, physical oceanographer and senior scientist at HUI, and John Bologna, sound artist with Harmonic Laboratory and senior instructor of audio production at the University of Oregon. Amy, tell us about the data. You want to use authentic data mm-hmm. here, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
We've been, even though it's been suggested to us a couple of times otherwise, we made a decision early on that we wanted to use authentic ocean data to help connect people with what's really going on in the ocean. People can see through, like, this looks like fake data, you know? or not fake data, but idealized or smoothed or, to make it easier to convey. And I get that. But the ocean's a messy place. There's a lot of processes going on simultaneously. Yeah. And part of an oceanographer's job is to disentangle all the different processes to focus on the one that's of particular interest at the moment. So we wanted to make sure we used real data so people understood what's really going on in the ocean.
John, talk about how you determine the best way to sonify concepts and how you work through sounds to use. How does, scale, pitch, and rhythm factor in?
Oh, man. this is where it becomes fun, but also very challenging because sometimes there are so many different options that you can choose. A common one is that you can, looking at a filter on white noise like we heard in the sonification of carbon net flux. Another one that I'm kind of thinking about will be a frequency of tone mapping. So in that frequency, values are mapped. So a tone will get not only it'll get higher in pitch, or as we pitch is just perceived frequency, or lower in that frequency. But sometimes I will map it onto two parameters. This happens a lot in musical instruments. So not only will I map it to frequency, but I'm gonna also map it to, say, amplitude or the volume, perceived amplitude. So as it gets goes up, we might see an increase in frequency, but we'll also see an increase in amplitude. It'll get louder. And then as the values go down, we'll get a decrease in frequency and we'll get a decrease in volume. Other times I'll even add in this filter on frequencies to make things brighter as they get louder. If you think about an instrument like the trombone, brass instruments, when a trombone and you're blowing in the trombone, very low volume, it's kind of a darker sound. And as you get forte, you really blow in hard into the trombone, not only is it louder, it gets brighter. So our natural world, as we're hearing things in the world and perceiving, things get louder and kind of get brighter. So I want to make sure that I'm cognizant of that in some of the data mappings. And sometimes it takes a little bit more work because I have to map these data values often to 2-3 parameters at one time, not just one.
Yeah, it's also fascinating. Our planet is warming because of increased levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and some people may not realize that the ocean has the capacity to absorb CO2, but it can also release or outgas CO2. Amy, talk about the movement of carbon dioxide between the atmosphere and the ocean and how temperature influences this exchange.
Yes, you did an excellent job summarizing it. the carbon dioxide is absorbed by the ocean. And overall, if you average over the entire global ocean, the ocean is a sink for carbon dioxide. So overall, at least for now, it's absorbing carbon dioxide. And that's saving our skin, I'll tell you, because if all that carbon dioxide were left in the atmosphere, we'd have a much bigger problem on our hands. So the ocean is acting like a sponge for CO2 overall. But it's not even around the planet. There are some areas where carbon dioxide is absorbed year-round, and it's because the water there is cold. Cold water can absorb more carbon dioxide than warm water. There are other areas, like off the coast of Cape Cod, for example, but many other places as well, where there's a seasonal cycle in water temperature. And so in the seasons when it's cold, the ocean is absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere. And when the season is warm, it's the opposite. The ocean expels CO2 back into the atmosphere.
Do we know why the colder water can hold more CO2?
It's a basic fundamental of physical chemistry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just the gases are more soluble in colder water.
Okay. We have a sonification of CO2 outgassing data. Let's give a listen.
Let's listen to some data. As you listen, outgassing will sound like this. The more gas that is released into the air, the more the sound will become louder and brighter like this. Now, let's listen to outgassing over the course of 1 year at the OOI Coastal Pioneer Array off the coast of New England in the North Atlantic. Listen to when outgassing occurs. More carbon dioxide is released from the ocean during the summer months when the water is warmer.
Winter. Spring. Summer. Fall.
Data from our neighborhood.
Yes, exactly. And I could add an analogy here is the soda can. Okay, you know, if you open a warm soda, right, all the carbon dioxide comes spewing out, right? Whereas if your soda is cold, it's not as much. Mm-hmm. It's exactly
good,
the same principles.
Good analogy. All right, let's give a listen to data sonification of CO2 being absorbed by the ocean.
What about when the ocean absorbs carbon dioxide? As you listen, absorption of carbon dioxide will sound like this. The more carbon dioxide that is absorbed into the ocean, the louder the sound will become, like this. In this soundtrack, we will hear absorption over the course of 1 year. Listen to how absorption changes throughout the year.
Winter. Spring. Summer. Fall.
Did you notice how much more carbon dioxide is absorbed from the ocean during the winter months when the water is colder?
John, in an earlier version of this data sonification, you used a different sound to signify absorption. So tell us what it was and why it changed.
So we first did a kind of a sound foundation survey, just trying to get user input on some of the choices that I was making just to confirm and validate, okay, this is what we want to try and do. And one of the choices that came back that resonated in that survey was kind of a slurping sound. Absorption should be a slurping sound, kind of like you're sucking through a straw. And we're like, okay, that's what you want. We'll go with it. And as we made iterations on our sonification prototype and we started evaluating in classrooms and in conferences, we found that it was a love-hate relationship with that sound. Yeah, other people loved it, or they were so averse they just wanted to stop listening. And so we tried to go through the kind of like annoying factor. It was annoying enough to enough people that were like, okay, we should change that sound. So we went back to the board and it came through a kind of a, Leslie was doing a conference with kids and they were like, you should do this. And they're really into, and they sent Amy or they sent Leslie a YouTube link of, this is what the sound should be like. And we're like, oh, wow, that was very specific. And I tried it out and it stuck.
It worked.
Yeah, we went with it.
All right. We have one final data sonification. Here's John again as narrator.
Now that you've heard outgassing and absorption processes separately, let's listen to them together. During the soundtrack, the sounds of outgassing will occur on the left channel, and the sounds of absorption will occur on the right channel.
Winter. Spring. Summer. Fall.
When we hear it all together, the ocean almost sounds like it is breathing. Breath in during the cold winter, breath out during the hot summer. Absorbing carbon dioxide when it's cold and then releasing or outgassing when it is warm.
Yeah, this is what we were talking about earlier where you said the ocean breathing. John, have there been data sets that are more challenging than others to sonify?
Oh, yes. it's, you know, we ended up dropping one of our sets, some ways due to time constraints, but also some of the challenge. But some of the challenges in the current sets that we have. When you need to overlay more than two sets of data, the kind of problem of information overload, I think it's a problem both in the visual domain as the auditory domain. So if we're overlaying or mixing multiple streams together and we want those to be clearly articulated, it can present a challenge. For example, we have this extratropical storm Hermine. It's got six different ocean phenomena, each with its own data: precipitation, temperature, salinity, wind speed, wave height, surface current. So if you're trying to overlay all six streams together and listen to them, how do you pick out which stream is which? And be able to identify kind of some trends.
The relationships between different variables.
It gets complicated, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very.
So, Amy, are there particular data sets out there that you'd like to tackle going forward?
Oh, yes. Yes. They are very specific, actually, what I would generally call a topographic map. Many people who hike or look at maps, you know what a topographic map is, a map of the land with contours that indicate elevation. So they know which steep trail to avoid, or what's the best walking route. We use that kind of three-dimensional map. It's really, even though it's on paper, it's really displaying three-dimensional information, X, Y, and height. And in ocean science, many of the earth sciences, we map properties like the temperature of the ocean at the surface everywhere in the North Atlantic. And so it's a spatial information. And that is very challenging to access, either with sonification, sometimes tactile, like a 3D map or 3D print. It helps.
Yeah. John, how could data sonification be broadened to other disciplines or expanded to be more interactive?
Right. I think this multiple modalities is a one opportunity for sonification and auditory display. Just the fact that you can, on this spatial map, thinking about how sound alone presents a challenge, but if we're including where your finger is on, say, a topographic map, is going to be the way in which we'll play back the sound. So there's this tactile plus a sound reinforcement of information. That could be one way of broadening, making interactive. Thinking about how sonification in or even just auditory displays in text can improve our existing graphs. A lot of graphs that we have don't even describe what's going on. And so improving data literacy, if you're already kind of feeling some PTSD from elementary science class and you don't want to interact with a graph, having an audio description of that graph for you might make an entry point for you to understand that information a little bit better. So we can use sound to kind of help exemplify or just even just narrate, describe, as well as sonify quantitative information that we might be displaying visually.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. It could just see this good, really help in some of those younger classrooms, right, as we learn differently. We're going to post a link to the Accessible Oceans Project at our website, capeandislands.org. Amy Bauer, physical oceanographer and senior scientist at HUI, and John Bologna, sound artist and Harmonic Laboratory and senior instructor of audio production at the University of Oregon. Thank you both. This is so fascinating. Thanks for being here and
thank you for having us
on this. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.